Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and no matter where you stand on the NSA spy scandal and Edward Snowden, I'm sure it's top of mind. And some surveillance of current bestseller lists uncovers that spies and PIs are the focus of the summer's hottest titles. And I'm so pleased to have Daniel Silva with us today. His English Girl is soaring up the charts. So our mission, should we decide to accept it, and of course we do, is to investigate the genre together as we turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Readers, the book report begins with a brilliant mystery written by newcomer Robert Galbraith. Hold on. By now, no sleuthing is necessary to know the author, or she who cannot be named, is none other than J.K. Rowling. So is this title worth all the press? Yes. In fact, before critics knew who the real author was, they reviewed The Cuckoo's Calling as a brilliant mystery. After losing his leg to a landmine in Afghanistan, Detective Cormoran Strike is barely scraping by as a PI. Strike is down to one client and creditors are calling. To make matters worse, he's just broken up with his girlfriend and his office is his current domicile. Then John Bristow walks through the door. His sister, the legendary supermodel Lulu Landry, known to friends as the Cuckoo, had fallen to her death several months earlier. Police ruled it a suicide, but John is not convinced. Strike is plunged into a world of millionaire beauties, rock star boyfriends, and desperate designers. He's tempted by every variety of enticement and delusion. Robert Glenister narrates.
Strike absorbed the impact, heard the high-pitched scream, and reacted instinctively. Throwing out a long arm, he seized a fistful of cloth and flesh. A second shriek of pain echoed around the stone walls, and then, with a wrench and a tussle, he had succeeded in dragging the girl back onto firm ground. Her shrieks were still echoing off the walls, and he realized that he himself had bellowed. The girl was doubled up in pain against the office door, whimpering. Judging by the lopsided way she was hunched, with one hand buried deep under the lapel of her coat, Strike deduced that he had saved her by grabbing a substantial part of her left breast. A thick, wavy curtain of bright blonde hair hid most of the girl's blushing face, but Strike could see tears of pain leaking out of one uncovered eye.
"Sorry!" His loud voice reverberated around the stairwell. "I didn't see you. Didn't expect anyone to be there."
From under their feet, the strange and solitary graphic designer who inhabited the office below yelled,
"What's happening up there?"
And a second later, a muffled complaint from above indicated that the manager of the bar downstairs, who slept in an attic flat over Strike's office, had also been disturbed, perhaps woken by the noise.
"Come in here."
Strike pushed open the door with his fingertips, so as to have no accidental contact with her while she stood huddled against it, and ushered her into the office.
"Is everything all right?" called the graphic designer querulously.
Strike slammed the office door behind him.
"I'm okay," lied Robin, in a quavering voice, still hunched over with her hand on her chest, her back to him.
After a second or two, she straightened up and turned around, her face scarlet and her eyes still wet. Her accidental assailant was massive. His height, his general hairiness, coupled with a gently expanding belly, suggested a grizzly bear. One of his eyes was puffy and bruised, the skin just below the eyebrow cut. Congealing blood sat in raised white-edged nail tracks on his left cheek and the right side of his thick neck, revealed by the crumpled open collar of his shirt.
"Are you Mr. Strike?"
Yeah.
I'm the temp.
The what?
The temp from Temporary Solutions.
The name of the agency did not wipe the incredulous look from his battered face. They stared at each other, unnerved and antagonistic. Just like Robin, Cormoran Strike knew that he would forever remember the last 12 hours as an epoch-changing night in his life. Now it seemed the fates had sent an emissary in a neat beige trench coat to taunt him with the fact that his life was bubbling towards catastrophe. There was not supposed to be a temp. He had intended his dismissal of Robin's predecessor to end his contract.
How long have they sent you for?
A week to begin with, said Robin,
who had never been greeted with such a lack of enthusiasm. Strike made a rapid mental calculation. A week at the agency's exorbitant rate would drive his overdraft yet further into the region of irreparable. It might even be the final straw his main creditor kept implying he was waiting for.
Excuse me a moment.
He left the room via the glass door and turned immediately right into a tiny, dank toilet. Here he bolted the door and stared into the cracked, spotted mirror over the sink. The reflection staring back at him was not handsome. Strike had the high, bulging forehead, broad nose and thick brows of a young Beethoven who had taken to boxing, an impression only heightened by the swelling and blackening eye. His thick, curly hair, springy as carpet, had ensured that his many youthful nicknames had included Pube Head. He looked older than his 35 years.
That was The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Best-selling author Daniel Silva is widely acknowledged as one of America's most popular spy novelists. A former journalist and TV producer, Silva creates thoughtful, entertaining page-turners that crackle with authenticity and seem to stay one step ahead of breaking news. Silva's beloved hero, Gabriel Allon, art restorer, assassin, and spy, returns now in The English Girl. An English girl vanishes on the island of Corsica. Not just any tourist on holiday, she is Madeline Hart, a rising star in Britain's ruling party, whose good looks and keen mind have her on the fast track to a promising future. And she is also the Prime Minister's mistress. You have 7 days or the girl dies. With the receipt of this chilling warning, the fateful decision is made to bypass British authorities. An election looms and the Prime Minister must be protected from an explosive career-ending scandal. The deputy director of MI5 realizes there is only one person who he can trust with this high-stakes, off-the-books operation to find and recover the missing woman, Gabriel Allon. Readers, I'm thrilled to welcome Daniel Silva back to the Book Report.
Hi there. How are you guys?
Good. Daniel, many of your novels are based on actual news events. Is this the case with The English Girl?
Well, it's not based on one, but I'd certainly say it was inspired by the fact that about 3 years ago now, we got the news from the FBI that the Russians were operating a ring of illegal spies here in the United States. A lot of people thought that sort of activity by the Russians had ended with the Cold War. I was never convinced that it had, so I wasn't necessarily surprised by it. But the fact that Russia, our supposed friend, still inserts people into our country under assumed identities to spy on us and does the same in the United Kingdom, that was really the sort of the genesis of this novel.
Well, to reference another spy story in the headlines now, talk about Edward Snowden and the fact that he's, you know, sitting where he's sitting.
Well, you know, as someone who follows these issues, I never had any doubts that the National Security Agency, the NSA, was acting like a giant vacuum cleaner and sucking up every bit of information that flows over the World Wide Web and storing it and sorting it and running it through sophisticated computer programs and algorithms, you know, looking for potential terrorists. I knew that this sort of program and programs were taking place. That said, it was still a shock when Snowden stood up and said that the government was downloading my email and saving it forever. And, you know, I have to say that I, in a way, thank Ed Snowden for doing that. By the same token, I believe that he's an American traitor who needs to be brought back here in handcuffs and put on trial. So I have very mixed feelings about the case, I have to be honest. We have to have a sort of a discussion as a nation about what capabilities and powers we want our intelligence services to have when it comes to spying on us. And you know, that debate is underway right now. I mean, there are bills in Congress that would eliminate the power of the NSA to do these kinds of things, and we need to really decide whether that's in the best interest, security interests of the country, to handcuff the NSA like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, back to the English girl. The story begins with the disappearance of Madeline Hart. Talk a little about her.
Madeline Hart is a rising star in the British governing party. She works at party headquarters. But everyone assumes that she's going to be a member of parliament one day, that she's going to be perhaps a cabinet minister one day. But Madeline has a dark secret. She is the lover of the British prime minister. And so when she disappears without a trace on the island of Corsica, and then a few weeks later when a mysterious ransom note arrives at number 10 Downing Street, the British prime minister has a serious problem. And a serious moral dilemma. Does he go to the British police and risk his career, or does he try to find Madeline using secret means? Fortunately for us, he chooses the second option, and the person he chooses to find Madeline is my longtime hero, Gabriel Allon.
Right. And Christopher Keller, who we first met in The English Assassin, is back in this book.
Well, they were absolutely wonderful on the page together and great fun. And, I mean, you know, people think that you know, these guys tried to kill each other once. You know, how can they really work together? And the answer is, of course they can. And relationships like this in novels and in film are always better when there is past tension in them. And so it was just sort of a textbook, wonderful setup. They're both very compelling characters. They're both men of action with great senses of humor. And it was wonderful. And it really proved to be a smart decision on my part to pair them together in a novel.
Right. Well, Corsica plays a role in this novel. Did you visit there while researching the book?
Yes, I've been to Corsica a few times, and one of my favorite places on earth. It's a beautiful country, but more importantly, it has this history of separatism and violence and vendetta that make it just a natural setting for international intrigue. And so, Corsica is almost a character in the novel in a way.
Huh. When you begin to write a story, and this is actually your 13th book with Gabriel, does he take you places you hadn't quite planned on?
Well, sure. I think that oftentimes I will start a novel and not know exactly how it's going to end or how I'm going to get to that ending. And, you know, I've learned over the years that if I do my job correctly in the beginning and motivate everything properly and set the story in motion, that I can sort of put it on Gabriel's shoulders to finish it for me.
Hmm.
And this book was a little bit different in that it has a very startling plot twist in it. And I knew what that plot twist was early, you know, in the beginning. And I knew how the book was going to end before I started writing it. And so this one was a little bit different for me. But look, when you've had a character that you've been writing about for 13 years, you get to know each other a little bit. I know what he would do. I know how he would do it. And it's a great source of comfort.
Well, what is it about Gabriel that resonates so strongly with readers?
Well, I think the fact that he has two very distinct sides to his character. You know, he is an intelligence officer and assassin, but he's also one of the world's finest art restorers, and that sort of bifurcation in Gabriel's character allows me to take the stories in two very different directions. And the fact that many of the stories contain a very strong art component attract readers that might not necessarily pick up an international thriller. And I also have a large number of female readers, and that's not always the case for male espionage writers.
Right. Is Gabriel's passion and depth and breadth of knowledge on art restoration, is that all your research, or are you basing him on someone that you might know?
No, he's not based on anyone I know, and obviously he doesn't exist. I have to imbue him with all those characteristics, so I have to do all the work myself to make it realistic for him.
Well, it is so impressive. I know the very talented George Guidel performs the audiobook. Are you involved in any way with that production?
Not with the production. It is, you know, kind of taken out of my hands. We don't do abridgments anymore. In the old days, we used to put out two editions of an audiobook. And so I would have to go through the very painful process of approving an abridgment of my novels, which I just really couldn't bear to even read the script. It was just so cut up. But no, I help them with getting as many of the pronunciations right as I can. But I have to leave it in their hands at that point. We're all on a pretty tight deadline when we get to the end of a production process. So they just need me to kind of get out of the way, actually.
Is Gabriel back in your next book?
Well, I learned a long time ago to never talk about a book that isn't written. I will say that it is my intention at this moment that Gabriel will return next year.
All right.
How's that?
That's great. And we'll be looking forward to it because The English Girl is a real page-turner. Daniel, thank you so much for stopping by today. And now let's listen to a sampling of The English Girl, narrated by George Guidel.
Madeline was being groomed for a safe seat in Parliament and a ministry of her own. It was only a matter of time. Or so they said. Which made it all the more odd that at 27 years of age, Madeline Hart remained romantically unattached. When asked to explain the barren state of her love life, she would declare she was too busy for a man. Fiona, a slightly wicked, dark-haired beauty from the cabinet office, found the explanation dubious. More to the point, she believed Madeline was being deceitful. Deceitfulness being one of Fiona's most redeeming qualities, thus her interest in party politics. To support her theory, she would point out that Madeline, while loquacious on almost every subject imaginable, was unusually guarded when it came to her personal life. Yes, said Fiona, she was willing to toss out the occasional harmless tidbit about her troubled childhood, the dreary council house in Essex, the father whose face she could scarcely recall, the alcoholic brother who'd never worked a day in his life, but everything else she kept hidden behind a moat and walls of stone. Our Madeline could be an axe murderer or a high-priced tart, said Fiona, and none of us would be the wiser. But Alison, a Home Office underling with a much broken heart, had another theory. The poor lamb's in love, she declared one afternoon as she watched Madeline rising goddess-like from the sea in the tiny cove beneath the villa. The trouble is, the man in question isn't returning the favor. Why ever not? Asked Fiona, drowsily from beneath the brim of an enormous sun visor. Maybe he's in no position to. Married? But of course. You've never had an affair with a married man? Yes. Just twice, but I'm considering a third. It was then, on the afternoon of the seventh day, and upon the thinnest of evidence, that the three girls and two boys staying with Madeline Hart in the rented villa at the edge of Piana took it upon themselves to find her a lover. And not just any lover, said Pauline. He had to be appropriate in age, fine in appearance and breeding, and stable in his finances and mental health, with no skeletons in his closet and no other women in his bed. Fiona, the most experienced when it came to matters of the heart, declared it a mission impossible. "He doesn't exist," she explained, with the weariness of a woman who had spent much time looking for him. "And if he does, he's either married or so infatuated with himself, he won't have the time of day for poor Madeline." Despite her misgivings, Fiona threw herself headlong into the challenge, if for no other reason than it would add a hint of intrigue to the holiday. Fortunately, she had no shortage of potential targets, for it seemed half the population of Southeast England had abandoned their sodden isle for the son of Corsica. There was the colony of city financiers who had rented grandly at the northern end of the Gulf di Porto, and the band of artists who were living like gypsies in a hill town in the Castagniccia, and the troupe of actors who had taken up residence on the beach at Campomurl, and the delegation of opposition politicians who were plotting a return to power from a villa atop the cliffs of Bonifacio. Using the cabinet office as her calling card, Fiona quickly arranged a series of impromptu social encounters, and on each occasion, be it a dinner party, a hike into the mountains, or a boozy afternoon on the beach, she snared the most eligible male present and deposited him at Madeline's side. None, however, managed to scale her walls, not even the young actor who had just completed a successful run as the lead in the West End's most popular musical of the season. "She's obviously got it bad," Fiona conceded as they headed back to the villa late one evening, with Madeline leading the way through the darkness on her red motor scooter. "Who do you reckon he is?" asked Allison. "Dunno," Fiona drawled enviously, "but he must be someone quite special." It was at this point, with slightly more than a week remaining until their planned return to London, that Madeline began spending significant amounts of time alone. She would leave the villa early each morning, usually before the others had risen, and return in late afternoon. When asked about her whereabouts, she was transparently vague, and at dinner she was often sullen or preoccupied.
That was The English Girl by Daniel Silva. Full Black is not Brad Thor's most recent novel, but it's the title his readers adore, so the Book Report is pleased to preview it for you now. Born in the shadows and kept from heads of state, there are some missions that are so deadly, so sensitive, they simply don't exist. When one such mission goes horribly wrong, a wave of terrorist attacks is set in motion. Their goal, the complete and total collapse of the United States. With the CIA's intelligent abilities hobbled, former Navy SEAL Team 6 member turned covert counterterrorism operative Scott Harvath launches an audacious plan to infiltrate the terrorist network and prevent one of the biggest threats the U.S. has ever faced. Simultaneously, a foreign team has been sent to California. Their target? One of Hollywood's most famous filmmakers. While working on a secret documentary, movie producer Larry Salamon has unknowingly exposed one of the world's wealthiest and most politically connected power brokers, a man with a radical anti-American agenda poised to plunge the nation into deadly, irreversible chaos. As the plots rocket to their conclusion and the identities of the perpetrators are laid bare, Harvath is left with only one course of action. Unable to trust anyone, he will be forced to go full black. Armin Schultz narrates.
His timing had been perfect. Swerving back into the lane at the last possible second, he watched in his rearview mirror as the white Skoda behind him careened off the road and slammed into a large tree. Applying his brakes, he pulled off the road and stepped out of his vehicle. The air smelled of spruce and spilled gasoline. The woman from the passenger side joined him. They had to move fast. Half their work had already been done for them. The terrorist in the Skoda's passenger seat had not been wearing his seatbelt. He was already dead. The driver was trying to unbuckle himself when Scott Harvath arrived at his window. He was cursing at him in Arabic from inside. Harvath removed a spark plug, often referred to as a ghetto glass breaker, from his pocket and used it to smash the window. Grasping the terrorist's head, Harvath gave a sharp twist and broke his neck. Gently, he guided the dead driver's chin down to his chest. The final passenger was a young Muslim man seated in the back of the car who was screaming. As Riley Turner opened his door, she could see he had wet himself. Painting his chest with the integrated laser sight of her taser, she pulled the trigger. The compressed nitrogen propulsion system ejected two barbed probes and embedded them in the young man's flesh. The insulated wires leading back to the weapon delivered a crackling pulse of electricity that incapacitated his neuromuscular capability. Yanking open the opposite door, Harvath carefully avoided the probes as he pulled the man from the vehicle and laid him on the ground. Once the man's hands were flex-cuffed behind his back, Harvath removed a roll of duct tape and slapped a piece over his mouth. Producing a pair of pliers, he yanked out the probes. The man winced and emitted a cry of pain from behind his gag. As he did, Harvath looked up and saw a familiar pearl-gray Opel minivan approaching. The van pulled parallel with the crash scene and slowed to a stop. The sliding door opened, and a man in his mid-20s, holding a shopping bag, stepped out into a puddle of radiator fluid and broken glass. The young operative's name was Sean Chase, and while he wasn't a perfect match, he was the best they had. Chase was the product of an American father and an Egyptian mother. His features were such that Arabs saw him as Arab, and Westerners often took him for one of their own. The question was, would the members of the Uppsala cell accept him? He was intended to be Harvath's ultimate listening device and was going to switch places with the young Muslim from the back seat of the Skoda, Mansour Alim. Mansour and the Uppsala cell were the only link the United States had to a string of terrorist attacks that had targeted Americans in Europe and the United States. And as bloody as those attacks had been, they were supposedly nothing compared to what intelligence reported the plotters were about to unleash. Subbing Chase for Mansour was the most crucial and the most dangerous part of the assignment. According to their limited intelligence, only two Uppsala cell members had ever met Mansour before and actually knew what he looked like. The men were friends of his uncle, a terrorist commander by the name of Azim Alim. The men had been dispatched to Arlanda Airport in Stockholm to collect Mansour and return him to the cell's safe house 2 hours north. Thanks to Harvath, they were now both dead.
We've just heard Full Black by Brad Thor. Dave Robichaux is back in Light of the World, book 20 of James Lee Burke's wildly popular series. Serial killer Asa Surrett narrowly escaped the death penalty for the string of heinous murders he committed while capital punishment was outlawed in Kansas. But following a series of damning articles written by Dave's daughter, Alifair, about other crimes possibly committed by Surrett, the killer escapes from a prison transport and heads to Montana, where an unsuspecting Dave is vacationing with daughter Alifair, his wife Molly, faithful partner Cleet, and Cleet's newfound daughter, Gretchen Horowitz, whom listeners met in Burke's recent Creole Belle. Will Patton performs the tale that pits Robichaux against one of the most diabolical villains he's ever faced.
I didn't serve and protect as a police officer. I witnessed the justice system's dysfunction and the government's empowerment of corporations and the exploitation of those who had no political voice. And while I brooded on all that was wrong in the world, I continued to stoke the furnace inside me with blackjack and Smirnoff's and five-star Hennessy and finally two jiggers of scotch inside a glass of milk at sunrise, constantly suppressing my desire to lock down on my enemies with the .45 automatic I had purchased in Saigon's brothel district and with which I slept as I would a woman. My real problem wasn't the militarization of my country or any of the other problems I've mentioned. The real problem went back to a mystery that had beset me since the destruction of my natal home and family. My father, Big Aldous, was on the monkey board of an offshore drilling well when the drill bit punched into an early pay sand and a spark jumped off the wellhead, and a mushroom of flaming oil and natural gas rose through the rigging like an inferno ballooning from the bottom of an elevator shaft. My mother, Allifair May Guillory, was seduced and blackmailed by a gambler and pimp named Mac, whom I hated more than any human being I ever knew, not because he turned her into a barroom whore, but because of the Asian men I killed in his stead. Rage and bloodlust and alcoholic blackouts became the only form of serenity I knew. From Saigon to the Philippines, from Chinatown in Los Angeles to the drunk tanks of New Orleans, the same questions haunted me and gave me no rest. Were some people made different in the womb, born without a conscience, intent on destroying everything that was good in the world? Or could a black wind blow the weather vane in the wrong direction for any of us and reshape our lives and turn us into people we no longer recognized? I knew there was an answer out there someplace if I could only drink myself into the right frame of mind and find it. I stayed 90 proof for many years and got a bachelor's degree in self-immolation and a doctorate in chemically induced psychosis. When I finally entered sobriety, I thought the veil might be lifted and I would find answers to all the Byzantine riddles that had confounded me. That was not to be the case. Instead, a man who was one of the most wicked creatures on earth made his way into our lives. This is a tale that maybe I shouldn't share, but it's not one I want to keep inside me either.
We've just heard a sampling of Light of the World by James Lee Burke. Allifair Burke is the author of two popular series that have earned her a reputation for creating strong, believable, and likable female characters. Allifair's interest in crime began in the late 70s, when, as a child, her family moved from Florida to Kansas. The move was at the time when a serial murderer, a man who called himself BTK, short for Bind, Torture, Kill, was terrorizing Wichita. The Burke's new home fell within the killer's stalking territory, and it left quite an impression on young Allifair. Allifair attended Reed College in Portland, Oregon. After graduating Phi Beta Kappa, she went on to Stanford Law and decided to pursue a career in criminal law. She accepted a judicial clerkship with the Circuit Court of Appeals before accepting an appointment as deputy district attorney in Portland. After 5 years at the DA's office, Allifair was ready to marry her love of crime fiction with the knowledge she'd gathered as a prosecutor. Her first novel, Judgment Calls, introduced readers to feisty Portland prosecutor Samantha Kincaid. Next, Allifair moved to New York City, where she still teaches criminal law and procedure at Hofstra Law School. She felt the time was right to begin writing from a police officer's perspective. So, NYPD detective Ellie Hatcher was born. Allifair is often asked about the origin of her name, especially by readers familiar with her dad, James Lee Burke, and his fictional character, Allifair Robichaux. Allifair, though, was named for her father's maternal grandmother, a common name in the South at the turn of the 20th century. Today we'll talk with Allifair about her new book, If You Were Here. Welcome, Allifair. Thanks for joining us on the Book Report today.
Thank you so much for having me.
McKenna Jordan is your new central character. Tell us about her.
Well, she's a former prosecutor like me, turned writer like me, but she's chasing down the story of a woman who heroically saves a kid from the when he falls into the subway tracks, and you know, she's just trying to figure out who this woman is, and she finally gets a grainy cell phone footage of the incident, and when she is finally able to see the woman's face, she's shocked to think that it's her long-missing friend, Susan Houtman, who disappeared without a trace 10 years ago. So the book is, as a thriller, it's her search for the truth about whatever happened to her friend and if that woman is, in fact, her missing friend. But it's also, in my mind, a book very much about the choices we make, that she reflects a lot about her life 10 years ago and Susan's life and her husband, whom she met through Susan. And it's really about the decisions that all three of these people made over the course of 10 years.
Now, reviewers say this is your most personal book to date. How so?
Well, like I said, McKenna shares my professional background. Her husband, Patrick Jordan, is a West Point graduate who now works in private security, which is my husband's background. And the notion that the two of them really have no shared past, other than their mutual friend Susan, the woman who disappeared, kind of taps into my own marriage when I met somebody that I didn't know. You know, we met each other online, which is, I guess, not that weird anymore. But if we hadn't met online, we wouldn't have met at all. And so we really had to get to know each other from true scratch, which in reality has worked out quite well. But I've always thought that, because I make things scary and nefarious, that when you get to meet somebody from true scratch, you're really taking a lot of trust, because everything they tell you about their past is exactly that. It's what they're telling you. You don't really have any kind of external validation. And as McKenna starts to look into what happened to Susan and all of Susan's relationships, including with her own husband, she starts to wonder whether there are things that her husband has hidden from her over time.
Hmm. You wrote McKenna was a natural rule follower. Even as a child, she would lecture her parents for parking in loading zones. Is that you?
I was the kind of kid who would tell on myself. If I did something bad, I'd feel such overwhelming guilt, I'd go tell on myself. Yeah, I call myself a rule follower. I don't know if that's a good trait or not.
Oh, I think so. Okay, so you've been so successful with Samantha Kincaid and also Ellie Hatcher, your two characters from series. What made you do this independent book?
Well, I wrote a standalone novel 2 years ago called Long Gone, and I found that as a writer that there's something about that that it permits you and also forces you, depending on whether you're feeling good about it or bad about it on a specific day, to write a bigger story. With the series books, I want Ellie Hatcher and Samantha Kincaid to be around a long time, and so there's a tendency as a writer to make their evolution gradual. Right? You can't do sudden changes because it might jar readers, and it might also be a decision that you might not want to live with over the course of years and decades. With a standalone, you're really telling a beginning, middle, and end of a character's story as far as the reader is concerned, and I found that really fun and Long Gone, that I could do a lot with the characters, and also the action kind of felt a little bigger. And this was a book that when I had the idea of, you know, somebody's missing for a long time and whether there are secrets to be told, there was really no reason for Ellie Hatcher to be in it. Ellie Hatcher is an NYPD detective, and if the story were told from her perspective, it would really just be from an investigator's perspective, and I think it would have been a less personal book, and you wouldn't have learned as much about the people who really should have been the primary characters.
Hmm. You had a very busy and successful career as a lawyer. What made you decide to become a writer?
Well, it was actually my experience as a prosecutor and as a reader that made me sort of stumble into this life I have now as a writer. I had been working at the DA's office for several years, and I was always a huge reader of fiction, and particularly crime fiction, and I started to realize that I was seeing a world at the DA's office that was very stylized. There's a certain way that prosecutors talk to each other and to police officers, and the attitude that law enforcement kind of has towards the court system and to crime generally, that I didn't really see in crime fiction. I mean, I thought that this little thing I was seeing in Portland, Oregon, which is where I practiced, I thought, you know, that world would really make good terrain for crime fiction, and after working there for several years, I had an idea. I probably never would have written it down except for that I followed a boy to New York. And so I was no longer working at the DA's office, and I took a summer off where I was supposed to be studying for the bar. I did study for the bar, but I also, bar exam, but I also decided I've always wanted to write a book, and I've always wanted to be better at golf, so I took some golf lessons. I got myself a computer and started what became my first book, Judgment Calls. I wrote about half of it that summer, and then it took me another 3 years, I think, to finish it. But I thought I'd write one book, and it would be on my shelf forever, and I could show it to people. But I've been lucky enough that that turned into a career for me.
Hmm. Do you think you and your dad will ever write a book together, a Dave Robichaux, Ellie Hatcher thriller?
I would love it. I would love it, but then I flash back to, you know, him trying to teach me how to drive and me finally having to go to my brother and say, will you please do this instead? You know, we're both very solitary workers. You know, we're both our own bosses for a reason. And so if we work together, it's a question. I mean, he'd obviously have to be the boss, and then I go back to being the kid being taught how to drive again. No, the real difficulty actually is neither one of us outlines. We just kind of feel something in our bones that makes us want to start writing a specific story, and we just let the characters kind of lead the way through the next 500 pages or something, which is an insane way to write and very, you know, it's not healthy probably, but I don't know how two people write together if neither one of them is planning anything. If somebody could figure that out for us, I think we'd love to do it.
Huh.
Maybe a short story or something that might be more manageable. Hmm.
All right, so what's the next project you're working on?
I'm working on the next Ellie Hatcher book. It should be out next year.
And working title?
I always write the titles last.
Okay.
Once I know what the book's about. But it's a, you know, I'm still a law professor, and I write, in my professional life, I write about wrongful convictions. So Ellie kind of gets pulled into a potentially wrongful conviction case. So that should be good. She's working with her boyfriend, who's a DA, which leads to some interesting situation.
Mm. Readers, I want to let you know that If You Were Here is a real page turner. Definitely pick it up this summer. Alifair, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Alrighty, bye.
Bye-bye.
Like father, like daughter. And now, let's listen to a sampling of If You Were Here, narrated by Roxanne Hernandez.
He heard the rattle of the approaching train, watched the lights heading his way, joined the other cattle gathering close at the edge of the platform in eager anticipation of scoring a New York commuter's lottery ticket, an empty seat. 6 trains had come and gone without a baby in her candy. This time, as the train lurched to a halt, Nikki saw what he'd been looking for through the glass of the car doors. Eyes down, phone out. Reddish-blonde hair pulled into a ponytail at the nape of her neck. Long-sleeved white sweater, backpack straps looped over both shoulders. Despite the train's lurch, she typed with 2 hands, stabilizing herself against the bounce with her core strength. Maybe that should have been a sign. He stepped 1 foot into the car, grabbed the phone, and pivoted a 180 like he had 50 times before. He pushed through the clump of angry riders who had followed him into the car and now stood before him, all hoping to secure a few square feet on the crowded train before the doors closed. Had he known what would happen next, maybe he would have run faster for the staircase. It wasn't until he hit the top of the landing that he realized he had a problem. Somehow, he heard it. Not the sound of the shoes, but the sound of surprised bystanders reacting. "Hey, what the? You lost your shoe, lady! Oh my God, David, we have to leave the city!" Nikki sneaked a glance behind him to see the woman kicking off her remaining ballet flat as she took 2 steps at a time in pursuit. She had looked sort of average middle-aged through the subway doors, but now she had a crazy look of determination on her face, in her eyes, in the energy of her forearms as they whipped back and forth at her sides. At the top of the stairs, he spun left and then right, up the ramp toward the electronics store positioned between the NR tracks and the 1-2. Why were some trains labeled with letters and others with numbers? Strange how random thoughts popped into his head when he was stressed. He could hear the thump of an old Run DMC song that his father listened to when he was still around. Nikki was in luck. The breakdancers always attracted a dense semicircle of onlookers. He leaped over a stroller on the near side of the audience, evoking an ooh from viewers who thought his vault across the makeshift stage was part of the act. Picked up the pace once again, gaze fixed on the stairs that would take him to the 1-2 platform. He heard more shouts behind him. The crowd hadn't stopped her. A kid cried as he fell to the ground. Girl wasn't messing around. He sprinted down the stairs, hoping to hear the familiar clack of an incoming train. No luck. He thought about abandoning the phone, but the platform was too packed. The phone would fall to the ground, unnoticed by her, scooped up by someone whose good luck today rivaled his bad. He decided to use the crowd to his advantage.
We've just heard If You Were Here by Alafair Burke. When Walter Mosley burst onto the literary scene in 1990 with his first E.Z. Rollins mystery, Devil in a Blue Dress, he captured the attention of critics and readers alike. 11 books later, in Little Green, E.Z. Rollins, P.I., returns from the brink of death to investigate the dark side of L.A.'s 1960 hippie haven, the Sunset Strip. The tale begins as E.Z. recuperates from a terrible car accident. True to form, the tough World War II vet is soon cruising the mean streets with sidekick Mouse, looking for a young black man, Evander Little Green Noon, who disappeared during an acid trip. Fueled by an elixir called Gator's Blood, brewed by the Conjure Woman Mama Jo, E.Z. experiences a physical, spiritual, and emotional resurrection. But peace and love soon give way to murder and mayhem. Michael Boatman narrates.
My vision was still playing tricks on me. I could see the young woman, but the room around her was blurred, without specific detail or spatial form. I said. Lynn smiled and moved toward the edge of the boxy chair. Do you remember what happened? She asked. The question almost brought me to tears. I concentrated so hard that I began to tremble. Lynn took hold of my cold hand and squeezed.
It's okay, baby. You had an accident, Lynn said.
She smiled. Her teeth were perfect. It was very bad, but you're pretty much all right. You've been coming in and out of consciousness for the last 2 months. Don't you remember?
No.
You will. Is this a hospital? No. The nondescript room behind Lynn got lighter, but I still couldn't make it out.
Where?
It's the house that Joelle McDonald got you when you were trying to protect your family.
How did I get here, Lynn? What happened?
I don't know the whole story, E.Z.
Tell me what you do know.
The doctor said that when you came to and could talk, we should make sure you stay calm.
I'm calm. I need to know what happened.
You were drunk, trying to pass a truck on Highway 1.
So you're saying that if I'm not dead, I should be?
Everybody thought you were, Lynn said. Ray got the call from your son at 4 a.m. They found your license on the beach and the registration in the glove compartment of your car. It had crashed into the surf.
And I was in the water, too?
Your body was lost. The driver's side door was torn off. The police told us that you had probably floated out on the tide.
So what happened?
I went up to the house with Raymond. Later in the morning, after Christmas Black came to watch the kids, Ray and I drove over to Mama Jo's.
The image of the tall, black witch woman came up into my mind's eye. Just the thought of her power and magnetism anchored my floating thoughts. What did Joe have to do with it?
I was imagining some mystical rite where the witch had made a bargain with the devil to raise the dead. Ray told her that you had died and that he wanted her to perform the funeral ceremony, especially since the body had been washed away.
And did she agree?
She looked Raymond in the eye and grabbed him by both shoulders, Lynn said, still astonished by the act. She even lifted him up on his toes, and all Ray did was stare back. After a minute or so, she let him go and stood up so tall that her head almost touched the roof of the cottage, and she said, "Your friend is not dead, Raymond. While you're here feeling sorry for yourself, he's out there in pain, near death. Go back to where that accident happened and look for him. Look close.
That was a sampling of Little Green by Walter Mosley. In Karen Slaughter's Unseen, Bill Black is a scary guy. He's a tall ex-con who rides to work on a Harley and trails an air of violence wherever he goes. In Macon, Georgia, Bill has caught the eye of a wiry little drug dealer and his cunning girlfriend. They think Bill might be a useful ally. What they don't know is that Bill is Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent Will Trent. Or that he's fighting his own demons as he's deep undercover and cut off from the support of Sarah Linton, the woman he loves. Sarah has come to Macon because of a cop shooting. Her stepson Jared has been gunned down in his home. Sarah holds Lena, Jared's wife, responsible. Without knowing it, Sarah gets involved in the same case Will is working, and soon danger is swirling around them both. Kathleen Early narrates Book 8 in the popular Will Trent series.
Detective Lena Adams winced as she pulled off her T-shirt. She took her police badge out of her pocket, along with her flashlight and an extra clip for her Glock, and tossed them all onto the dresser. The time on her phone showed it was almost midnight. Lena had rolled out of bed 18 hours ago, and now all she wanted to do was fall back in. Not that she'd done that much lately. For the past 4 days, just about every waking hour had been wasted sitting at a conference room table answering questions she'd answered the day before, and the day before that, navigating the usual that came from having to justify your actions to internal affairs. Who led the raid into the house? What intelligence were you acting on? What did you expect to find? The internal investigator for the Macon Police Department had the dour, lifeless personality of a career pencil pusher. Every day, the woman showed up dressed in the same style black skirt and white blouse, an outfit that seemed more appropriate for greeting diners at an Olive Garden. She nodded a lot, frowned even more as she took notes. When Lena didn't answer quickly, she checked the tape recorder to make sure it was picking up the silences. Lena was certain the questions were designed to provoke an outburst. The first day, she had been so numb that she just answered truthfully in the hope that it would soon be over. The second and third days, she'd been less forthcoming, her level of irritation rising with each passing minute. Today, she had finally exploded, which seemed exactly what the woman had been waiting for. "What do you think I expected to find, you miserable—" If only Lena hadn't found it. If only she could take a razor and slice the images out of her brain. They haunted her. They flickered into her vision like an old movie every time she blinked. They filled her with a constant, unrelenting sorrow. Lena started to rub her eyes, then thought better of it. 6 days had passed since she'd led her team on the raid, but her body was still a walking reminder of what had happened. The bruise fingering its way across her nose and underneath her left eye had turned a urine yellow. The 3 stitches holding together the cut in her scalp itched like a rash.
That was Unseen by Karen Slaughter. In Bad Monkey, Andrew Yancey, late of the Miami Police and soon to be late of the Monroe County Sheriff's Office, has a human arm in his freezer. Okay, there's a logical explanation for that, but not for how and why it parted from its shadowy owner. The boating accident / shark lunch explanation seems full of holes, and if Yancey can prove murder, the sheriff might rescue him from his grisly health inspector gig. But first, this being a Carl Hiaasen book, Yancey must negotiate an obstacle course of wildly unpredictable events with a crew of crazy characters. Here is Hyacin doing what he does best, spinning a tale at once fiercely pointed and wickedly funny, in which the greedy, the corrupt, and the degraders of what's left of pristine Florida get their comeuppance. Take note, though, you may want to choose the print version of this title, as most readers are not fans of Artie Johnson's narration.
On the hottest day of July, trolling in dead calm waters near Key West, a tourist named James Mabry reeled up a human arm. His wife flew to the bow of the boat and tossed her breakfast burritos. "What are you waiting for?" James Mabry barked at the mate. "Get that thing off my line." The kid tugged and twisted, but the barb of the hook was embedded in bone. Finally, the captain came down from the bridge and used bent-nose pliers to free the decomposing limb, which he placed on shaved ice in a deck box. James Mabry said, "For sake, now where are we supposed to put our fish?" "We'll figure that out when you actually catch one." It had been a tense outing aboard the Misty Mama 4. James Mabry had blown three good strikes because he was unable to absorb instruction. Dragging baits in the ocean was different than jigging for walleyes in the lake back home. "Don't we need to call somebody?" he asked the captain. "We do." The hairy left arm was bloated and sunburned to the hue of eggplant. A cusp of yellowed humerus protruded at the point of separation, below the shoulder. The flesh surrounding the wound looked ragged and bloodless. "Yo, check it out," the mate said. "What now?" James Mabry asked. "His freaking finger, dude." The victim's hand was contracted into a fist, except for the middle digit, which was rigidly extended. "How weird is that?" "He's flipping us off," the mate said. The captain told him to rebait the angler's hook. "Has this ever happened out here before?" James Mabry said. "Tell the truth." "You should go see about your wife. They'll never hear the end of it. She did not want to come fishing." "Well, son," the captain said, "we're in the memory-making business." He climbed back to the bridge, radioed the Coast Guard, and gave the GPS coordinates of the gruesome find. He was asked to remain in the area and look for other pieces of the body. "But I got a charter," he said. "You can stay at it," the Coast Guard dispatcher advised. "Just keep your eyes open." After calming herself, Louisa Mabry informed her husband that she wished to return to Key West right away. "Come on, sugar, it's a beautiful morning." James Mabry didn't want to go back to the dock with no fish to hang on the spikes, not after shelling out a grand to hire the boat. "The first day of our honeymoon and this. Aren't you sketched out?" James Mabry peeked under the lid of the fish box. "You watch CSI all the time. It's the same type of deal." His wife grimaced, but did not turn away. She remarked that the limb didn't look real. "Oh, it's real," said James Mabry, somewhat defensively. "Just take a whiff. Snagging a fake arm wouldn't make for as good a story. The real arm was pure gold. Major high fives from all his peeps back in Madison." "You caught a what?" "No way, bro." Louisa Mayberry's gaze was fixed on the limb. "What could have happened?" she asked. "Tiger shark," her husband said matter-of-factly. "Is that a wedding band on his hand? This is so sad."
We've just heard Bad Monkey by Carl Hyacin. Readers, this week's show was, in many respects, James Bondian. And how much fun is that? There are still some weeks of summer left. Time to indulge in those page-turning thrillers at the beach or pool. If you need more suggestions, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining in today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.